Good afternoon. We're going to call the State Government Finance Division, I guess it is, to order. First order of business are the minutes, and I'm sure that Representative Poppe would like to move approval of the minutes.
So moved.
Any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Very well. Meetings are approved. Today we have an agenda that at first blush may seem a little bit unusual to have the State Auditor Rebecca Otto and Jim Noble as the Legislative Auditor. That makes sense. But then we're also going to hear from the Gambling Control Board, Mr. Tom Barrett, their Executive Director. And it actually does make good sense, as you'll soon hear from Auditor Otto. And so we're going to start right away with the Auditor. I guess the only preface I would make generally today is that yesterday in the Finance Committee we had a hearing and heard from the State Auditor on a number of the findings that their commission, their office has made over the last year. And it, I think, is the next step for divisions under the Finance Committee to begin looking at some of the specific findings as it applies, as they may apply to the accounts that the divisions are responsible for. So that's the beginning of this effort, I guess, today, is to get some background from the State Auditor and from the Legislative Auditor. So please identify yourself for the record, Madam Auditor, and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Rebecca Otto. I'm the Minnesota State Auditor, and I'm very honored to be here today to address you this early in the session. Thankful that I was invited, and I know that today will be very important for all of you. I know some of the members are new on the committee, and so you're going to get a chance to see some of the work that the Office of the State Auditor does. Now, I'm not naive to realize that there are people that have no idea what our office does, and that's okay. Or they think they may know. Sometimes I walk up to someone and I'll tell them I'm the State Auditor, and they think I audit their tax returns, and they usually take a step back, but we don't do that. So today what we'd like to do, I'm here with a staff member from our office, Nancy Bodie from our Legal and Special Investigations Division, and we'll both be doing a presentation to you that's brief and pretty straight to the point. And we were asked to come in and talk about our work, and we're going to relate it to the economic downturn that is occurring right now and some of the concerns we have and some of the things we've seen, because we would like to prevent and detect fraud. Now, I wanted to tell you what our jurisdiction is. We actually, our office oversees local governments, that's cities and counties, towns, special districts, sometimes schools, local public pension plans, so it's very broad. We do our work, our oversight work, through auditing, reviewing, reporting, educating, and investigating. Today we're going to focus on the investigation part of our work. And just to give you an idea of the scope of the number of entities we have, there's about 4,300 units of local government in the state, which is a lot. And then you have different types, so they have different laws that pertain to them depending on their size. So it's fairly complicated. And local government is always a moving target. There's always new people coming in and people leaving, and so our work never stops. I wanted to familiarize you briefly with a statute, 609.456, which requires local officials, if they suspect theft or misuse of public funds, they're required to report to the Office of the State Auditor to let us know that that's occurred. And I wanted to let you know, as the economy started to change, now back in 2007, we had 609 reports. So 39 different entities contacted us saying they suspected misuse or theft of public funds. In 2008, we got 64 609s. So there was approximately a 64% increase in the number of reports. But still, if you look at it overall, it's less than 1% of all those units of local government. That's the good news. There's a lot of good work going on in local governments around the state, but there are still some problems. So the presentation today, there's a really basic concept I want to show you and will be useful in all the work that you do in the legislature, I believe, and because oversight is critical when you're talking about public funds. There's a sociologist who did a study some years ago, and he looked at employee theft, so when employees steal from their employer. And the sociologists found that there were three factors always present when there was theft. First of all, there was the opportunity to steal. That's something that actually can be controlled. The top point of the triangle is the opportunity point, and it's something that can be controlled. Then there's rationalization. The person says, I'm going to pay it back, or they don't pay me enough, or they'll never miss it. And the final triangle, point of the triangle is the motive or incentive or financial pressure. The person either has a gambling addiction or maybe their spouse has lost their job, sometimes healthcare costs. There's different factors that can affect that. Our office most often sees gambling, but there are other factors as well. So that's the fraud triangle. I'm going to refer back to that several times today as we go through the presentation, and it's not too long. So, our office is always looking to help local governments reduce the opportunity that people can actually misuse funds. And so there's tools of protection. So we want them to prevent and or allow for early detection of fraud. And they can do that through something called segregation of duties, internal control procedures, and the environment. Now, some of you may think this sounds awfully boring, but I'm telling you it really isn't. It's actually really interesting, and I'm going to make it really interesting for you. So what I'd like to do is the work that we've done with local governments and some of those 6 or 9 reports that have come in, Nancy's going to cover 4 case studies with you briefly today. Some of the things we've seen to get an idea of the issues that we've run into. So, Nancy Bode.
I am Nancy Bode.
Please go ahead.
And I was asked by Auditor Otto to go through 4 examples for you of the kinds of things that unfortunately we see. The first one we thought we could talk about is an example that isn't unusual for local units of government because it's a very small political subdivision. There were 2 employees. One handles all of the financial work, the other handles the other work that needs to be done. So it's a very small entity. And when we had a situation with no segregation of duties, that is, the one person who handled all the financial side wrote the check, got the bank statements, reconciled the bank statements, and then the next month would write more checks. We unfortunately found that she wrote herself over $334,000 in unauthorized checks over a 5-year period of time. Small entity. Problem, no segregation of duties. No one noticed because there were no segregation of duties. When we see something like that, there are some solutions. And so what we try to do is explain to people why segregation of duties, which sounds so boring, is important. And I always try to just explain to people it means, in totally non-auditor terms, you want somebody who commits a crime not to be in a position where they could cover up the crime. So you want to have built-in double checks, redundancies, so someone else is looking. In a situation where you have a very small entity, 2 employees, we try to make very practical suggestions and recommendations to the entity. So we would recommend, well, maybe you need to have one of your board members receive and review the bank statements. Something simple, not a lot of extra cost, but quickly, we think, someone would have noticed that one of the employees was getting a lot more checks than she was entitled to. Another example we thought we would talk about is an example showing, in addition to lack of segregation of duties, some weak internal control. And this is unfortunately a situation up in Norman County East School District. We had one person who was handling the finances, and we found that she was not, as people would turn in funds, writing receipts for everyone. And we uncovered a lapping scheme. What is lapping? Well, it's pretty easy, actually. Let's say I am the bookkeeper and I need to make a deposit of $1,000 because I've receipted that I've gotten in $1,000 that I need to take to the bank. $500 is in cash, $500 is in checks. Then it's my lucky day because in walks another check for maybe $250, let's say. Well, if I don't receipt that check so no one knows I got that check, I can put the check into my $1,000 deposit, take out the $250 cash, and no one's the wiser. That's a very simple example of a lapping situation, which unfortunately we find from time to time. In this situation, we found lapping, and it was unfortunately $119,000 worth over a 20-month period of time. We also found the checks that were written to the school district were taken to the bank and cashed. We also found that some cash collections, so gate receipts, lunches, were never recorded as receipts on the books. There again are solutions. In addition to the segregation of duties, we recommend some internal control procedures, the most obvious of which, I think, is to make sure somebody writes a receipt for all the money that's coming in and use pre-numbered receipts. But some of the smaller entities just haven't sort of figured out why that's important yet. And this is a good case study, usually, to say, well, here's why it's important. Checks should be endorsed right away for deposit only. Deposits should be timely, because if someone is engaged in a lapping scheme, you usually have to wait for that extra check to come in that you can put in your deposit and remove the cash. So deposits aren't timely. We also ask for segregation of duties. And again, a school district like Norman County East, it's small. I mean, there isn't a lot of extra money. So we tried to make very practical suggestions, such as having the athletic director or the annual advisor, the yearbook advisor, keep track of the money that they've turned in. When they've turned it into the bookkeeper, then periodically they should get a report of how much the yearbook has made or the athletic department has made. And then they can compare and make sure that the money has been deposited. I am pleased to say that Norman County East is implementing these changes. Another example is about being control environments. So it's the three tools of protection. And we thought we'd use the example of PAC4, which is a collaborative for counties. They had pretty good internal controls on paper. The problem was they had a director who engaged in something we call management override. So the rules applied to everyone but her. And as a result, we found gift cards that were given out to, well, we call them phantom recipients, people that didn't really exist. And then she was able to keep the gift cards. The solutions to that is to create an environment where rules apply to everyone. And really the tone has to be set as we go out and talk to local units of government by the elected officials, by the board members. They have to let everybody know that they think internal controls, segregation of duties, and the environment is important. So that's what we try to stress. The fourth case example we selected just to remind everyone that local units of government, like school districts, can be susceptible to some of the same frauds that the private sector are susceptible to. In particular, Ponzi schemes. Now, in 2008, unfortunately, the word Ponzi schemes, or the phrase, has become almost a household word. And people understand what that is. But back in 2004, when it was originally brought to us, it wasn't as well understood. And we had questions raised by a treasurer in a small school district up north. He was concerned about National School of Fitness Foundation, and we looked into it, and indeed, we uncovered a nationwide Ponzi scheme. And most of the victims, I am pleased to say, were in other states. So Minnesota only suffered a loss of approximately $1 million. Luckily, the federal authorities did come in, and the last sentences in that case were in December of 2007. So local units of government can be victims to the same kinds of financial scams that the private sector is susceptible to.
Auditor Otto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I just want to give credit to Nancy Bodie, who did uncover that national scheme. She was the person that was into it and found it, and we are very thankful as a state to have her as an employee, because her service is incredible. We're very lucky to have her talent in our office. I wish I had about six of her. I grabbed some headlines from some articles because, remember, I want to talk about fraud and economic downturn. And, you know, this can apply to state government, local government, business. It applies across all of them. All these articles should be in your packet. I grabbed some of the important quotes I thought that made sense in the national and international publications. The Register says, however, KPMG, which is one of the largest accounting and auditing firms in the country, warned that businesses could expect to see an increase in company fraud if the widely forecast economic downturn starts to bite, and it has bitten. PR News, for example, that last article, if we go back to that fraud triangle, the point we're talking about with that article, that businesses could expect to see more fraud, is because of financial pressure. It's that financial pressure point. PR News, for example, a reduction in workforce by way of terminations, layoffs, and early retirements invariably increase fraud risks. Fewer employees reduce the effectiveness of controls and increase risks. Fundamental breakdowns in internal controls will happen when there are insufficient employees available to perform basic review functions, such as reviewing journal entries, appropriate reconciling account balances, or monitoring inventory security. Going back to the triangle, now, in local government, if they have more pressure on their budgets and they do have to lay off more, realizing there's less people, it is more challenging for them. Same would apply to state government. And I know, let's say, Auditor Nobles will touch on that with you. That's his area. But it gets back to that you have increased opportunity when you have weaker internal control. So that's a concern in an economic downturn. BBC News, there's a direct correlation between the state of the economy and the amount of fraud. That gets back to the point of the triangle of financial pressure. This is more financial pressure on people. And finally, the Chartered Institute of Management Accountants. I'm sure there's nobody in this room that reads that publication. However, their quote was, earlier this month, KPMG Forensic issued a similar warning, stating that an economic downturn could lead to an increase in the number of frauds being uncovered. And the point there being, which you've seen in the news with Madoff and Petters, that when there's an economic downturn, there's less money to fill in these schemes, they fall apart. And so we've seen that with Madoff and Petters. We have seen a little bit more in our office as well when budgets get tighter and people start scrutinizing. Actually, that's sometimes when you find things. Or if somebody gets laid off and somebody goes in and says, there's a whole pile of checks in this drawer, how come? You know, we usually get a call. Yep, Nancy. oversight is actually more critical in an economic downturn than less. Going back to that triangle, opportunity is the top point, rationalization, motive, incentive, the three factors that are involved when there's stuff from an employer. The area that local governments control is opportunity, the opportunity to commit the fraud. In government, it would be the area that, you know, in business, it's the area that you actually can have some control over. There's something called SAS 99, Statement of Auditing Standard 99, which requires some questions to be asked during an audit. And I'm going to see if there's a familiar theme here. One of the questions, does the opportunity to commit fraud exist? So this could be asked within an entity. Are duties segregated, internal control procedures implemented, and a strong control environment created? Another question, do employees or management have an attitude that allows them to rationalize fraud? And finally, are employees or management under pressure? Do they have an incentive to commit fraud? These are asked of local government entities, but we also ask them to ask themselves these questions on a regular basis, to continue to look at and monitor, are we strong? Are we implementing our internal controls? Finally, with our investigative part of our office, Freedoms of Local Government, we provide specialized forensic auditing techniques that local governmental units cannot afford to purchase. This is one of the things that state government finance, one of the things that you provide general fund money for. We do not charge the entities when we go in and do an investigation because it's really important they can come to us. And if, let's say, you've got a school district that's in statutory operating debt, and so they're already behind the barrel and having a difficult time, and they suspect that there may be misuse of funds, they can call us and we can go in. It's very important because we help them determine the scope of the loss, which allows the entity to collect on bond or insurance and to seek restitution so they can get those public dollars back. We can provide internal control recommendations to prevent or detect early detection of fraud in the future, reduce that opportunity. And we also assist law enforcement and provide guidance to private CPAs and local governmental units when fraud is suspected. So We do a whole lot of work with very few staff, and there's more demand right now for our work, unfortunately. But as Nancy says, sometimes business is good, and that's not meant very seriously. But anyway, we would prefer that we didn't have to do these. We would prefer they're not there. Under my administration, I got a website listed. I've tried to take a very proactive and preventative approach with these entities. We'd rather not have this stuff happen in the first place. We want them to be strong. We want them to have good internal controls. We have gigantic entities like Minneapolis all the way down to entities like Henning. So there's a range of there's a range of sizes, and so they're all a little bit different. We do statements of position to guide them. Our investigative reports are listed on our website. We do issue internal control letters, which are on our website. We issue something weekly. It's electronic. It's called the e-update. And every week we have 4 or 5 points, and we have local government sign up. We have private CPA firms sign up. Lots of folks sign up. And there's a really popular feature in our e-updates called avoiding pitfalls. And I was asked by local officials, would you help us avoid the problems in the first place? They don't want the negative headlines. So every week, Nancy actually works up avoiding pitfalls for our entities. They're short. They're sweet. In an economic downturn, when this started to occur, we got a call one day that said, there's an issue with our gas card. Somebody was having a hard time affording gas to get to work, right? And a lot of people experienced that. Well, they had gas cards, and they discovered somebody was misusing it. They were using it to get to work. And so what we did was we issued an avoiding pitfall. That said, have you checked your gas card policies lately? And so after sending out that avoiding pitfall, we had some entities contact us to say, wow, thanks for the reminder. We actually caught something really early. And so what we try to do is help them. We look at some of the issues that might be coming through, and then we issue an avoiding pitfall. And I've had local government officials say to me, I've been in government for a really long time, and even though I know a whole lot, it's really nice to get those reminders. This is kind of a little checkup. And so with that, I would like to end our presentation and see if there are any questions from the committee.
Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Auditor Otto. Refreshed a little bit on the process. A number of years ago, Lakeville Area School District cash bag was found in the parking lot of Mystic Lake Casino. And it broke to some degree in the news. And then my recollection is that once the complaint is filed, you can't confirm or deny while an investigation is going on, but then certain things happen at the conclusion. Can you just briefly tell us how the process works, when information is public, when it's private, and how the data that you collect interacts with law enforcement's investigation, and a little bit about the details of how an investigation moves forward.
Ms. Otto?
Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg and members, I'm going to do a small piece of this, and I'm going to turn it to to Nancy, because she's going to have more details that I want to be very careful with. When the media calls our office and says, okay, we've heard there's a cash bag in this parking lot, and so are you going to do an investigation? And I unfortunately have to say every single time, which is given to me, we cannot confirm nor deny, because state law actually says once we're into something, well, whether we are or not, we can't confirm. That's one, okay? And if we were, we still wouldn't confirm. If we were doing an investigation, it would only be after it was done and completed that it would become public. And so the media will say sometimes, well, so if you're doing something and when you issue something, can we be on the list?
Yeah.
And that's usually how it goes with the media, because we really cannot talk about it. And that's by state statute that's required. And, Mr. Chair, if you don't mind, I'll let Ms. Bode fill in any blanks. So.
Ms. Bode.
Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, I'm not sure how much of your question she answered, but I think there was also a piece of how do we work with law enforcement. And law enforcement, of course, also can't talk about their open investigations just as we can. But we actually work fairly closely with law enforcement. Our statutes allow us to share our information with law enforcement. That's in our Chapter 6.715 is the statute. So we do work closely with law enforcement. Let's see, which one? Norman County East, that has been passed over to prosecutors and law enforcement. Coochaching EDA, we worked it up, and then we, by law, have to send it to the prosecutor. So we do that. Does that help?
Representative Holbrook.
And if I might, my recollection, and again, I'm dusting cobwebs here, so I may not remember everything correctly, but there was also an issue about employee records, and my recollection is that the law enforcement had a hard time getting employee records because the school district hadn't enacted any disciplinary action, so there was some tension or tug between that you couldn't, that while an employee is under investigation, there's certain protections for employees relative to their employee personnel jacket, and that there was this tension between law enforcement and the district, and that the law enforcement wanted access in the course of investigation of this possible fraud, but the employee lawyered up and asserted that the law enforcement could not have access to the employee record because she was falling under the protections of the employee being under investigation, and that there had been no discipline resolved.
Ms. Bodie?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holbrook, I don't remember that situation at all, but previous to working 8 years for the State Auditor's Office, I was in the Attorney General's Office. And I believe you're talking about the statute 13.43, which is in the Data Practices Act, and we very carefully in State Auditor's Office, I don't give any advice on 13.43. That can be a problem. Some years ago, we changed our particular statute, so now school districts are required to report to us. And I think the language is quite strong. It says, notwithstanding any provisions of Chapter 13, they will give us even not public information. We are required then to retain it in the same manner as it was in their hands. Law enforcement has had the problem of getting the issues of getting information from local units of government in employment type situations for a while.
And Representative Holbrook.
Mr. Chair, if I might, then are you able to then give that personnel data to law enforcement or not in that situation?
Ms. Bodie?
Mr. Chair and Representative Holbrook, I believe we are. Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, Ms. Bodie, there's no way you would remember me, but when I first started out as an attorney at the Attorney General's Office, you were head of the Public Safety Division, and soon after I arrived, you left. I don't think the two are connected, but maybe they are. But to either of you, or both of you, could you tell us the extent to which you collaborate or cooperate either with Mr. Nobles and the Office of Legislative Auditor or with other state agencies like the BCA or others? Is there some cooperative crossover there?
Ms. Otto.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon and members, I'll do one piece and then I will allow Nancy to do another piece. So, you know, Mr. Noble's jurisdiction is state government. We're local government. I've never had an issue with meeting with Mr. Nobles if we have questions or you want to compare notes, but pretty much, you know, they have their purview, we have our purview, and so that works out quite well. If there's ever anything we can do cooperatively, I'm always about that. You know, I think the government needs to work together if they can. In terms of BCA and some of the other agencies or whatever, Mr. Chair, if you don't mind, I'll let Ms. Bodie.
Ms. Bodie.
Mr. Chair and Representative Simon, I do remember you.
Do you care to share, Ms. Bodie?
No, just show how old I'm getting. Well, interestingly, we met with some staff members from the Legislative Auditor's Office just yesterday because we, from time to time, have concerns come in and we have to sort out whose failure it is. First, we have to figure out the funding stream. So we do talk to them routinely. We do not share cases because we have to be careful on the data practice issues. But we do talk about things we're finding and trends. So, and we often have to talk because we have to sort out whose is it. As for working with the BCA in particular, we often do end up working with law enforcement. Some of the smaller entities aren't really good at working the white-collar cases, don't have the staff, so we work with local law enforcement. We have worked with the BCA in I can think of at least one instance in the last year.
Representative Simon.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, to either or both of you, you haven't encountered, at least in recent history, major, for lack of a better phrase, turf battles. Sounds like you've been able to resolve those.
Mr. Chair, we're always interested, you know, in respecting the legislative auditor's purview. He's interested in respecting ours. And we are so short-staffed that there are times when, you know, if there's somebody that can do it or it's appropriate for them, that's good. You know, we just want to make sure things are taken care of. Sometimes law enforcement can do certain portions of it, and they'll ask us a couple of questions, or we'll help guide them if they have questions, so that we are really able to determine the scope. And so sometimes a private CPA will be in there, and, you know, we can, again, communicate with them based on our experience and knowledge and expertise. So there's a lot of cooperation that occurs. And the interest in keeping costs down for everybody involved is very important, too. So, yes.
A follow-up question. Does the legislative auditor audit your office?
Mr. Chair, yes. Yes, indeed. Okay. The legislative auditor audits our office. Yes.
Any further questions? Thank you, and we'll move on to Jim Nobles and the legislative auditor. Mr. Nobles, please identify yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor, and with me at the table is Cecile Ferkel, who is the deputy legislative auditor for our financial audit division. Some of you are starting to look quite familiar. You've heard from us quite a bit already. And I apologize to you. I'm going to cover just a little bit of the same ground, but I'll do it in summary fashion because I look and I see some who do not look familiar and may be new to the legislature and to this committee and not be all that familiar with us. Let me start where you were just before we got up here, and that is, how did we end up with two auditors, two audit offices? Some of you may be asking that question. It happened in 1972 when the legislature received a set of recommendations from a group that had been set up to study state government. It was called the Loaned Executive Action Program, or LEAP, as it was often called. And LEAP recommended that the legislative branch take on the oversight function in state government, that the audit function, the post-audit function, be a legislative function, a nonpartisan legislative function. And that was a position that the legislature accepted because, frankly, it fit well with what a lot of other state legislatures had in place. It also fit with the model at the federal level where the United States Congress has the GAO, or the, now it's called the Government Accountability Office. And so I think it's recognized that there is a very legitimate, appropriate, and constitutionally based oversight function for the legislature to perform. The state auditor was given responsibility for local auditing, as Ms. Otto mentioned, in 1972. And you might ask, since that was a constitutional office, it had been in the state of Minnesota since the Constitution was enacted, what had the state auditor been doing previous to that? Well, the state auditor originally was more or less a controller within state government and had really been performing that function and not doing post-audit work prior to 1972. So, who was doing the audit work before the legislative auditor's office was created and the state auditor was given the responsibility to audit local units of government? There was an appointee of the governor called the public examiner, who was the auditor of everything, state government, local government. And actually, the person who was the public examiner at the time the legislative auditor's office was created, Robert Whitaker, was appointed the legislative auditor, the first legislative auditor, and much of his office was brought into the legislative branch. The legislature decided to split this jurisdiction pretty much as Ms. Otto explained it. The legislative auditor has jurisdiction for state government. The state auditor has jurisdiction for local units of government. And I would just add, and I've worked over the years with many state auditors, and Ms. Otto's characterization, I think, is correct. It has been for all of my time as legislative auditor, and that is a considerable number of years, that we have never fought over turf. There is plenty of work to go around. We respect each other's purview and jurisdiction. And from time to time, as was mentioned, our staffs get together and sort out whether a particular allegation is within the state auditor's purview or ours. That usually occurs more from an ad hoc situation, a set of allegations. We know who we audit on an ongoing, regular basis, as do they. So these issues of who's going to do what really occur when an allegation comes in. And sometimes there can be some confusion. For example, there may be money that comes from a particular state agency going to a local unit of government as a grant, let's say. And there are allegations about how that money was used. Well, is it going to be audited as a state grant with the responsibility in the state agency, or is it going to be audited at the local level because that may be where the issue is? And that's what we get together and decide. And we don't battle over this. We decide, I think, in a very reasonable way based on the law who is going to take the action. Well, I would like to back up, though, Mr. Chairman, and just have Ms. Furfel talk a little bit. What I think we want to do is talk about how we get into our financial audit work and particularly issues about internal controls, which I think we want to sort of parallel some of the discussion that you just heard, because it is very similar to the work that we do. We go in and examine internal controls. We do take on, as I mentioned, issues from time to time on an ad hoc basis when there are allegations. But we, too, are really out there trying to prevent those kinds of things from happening still.
Ms. Furkle.
Thank you. I'm Cecile Furkle, the Deputy Legislative Auditor. I'm responsible for the Financial Audit Division. And in addition to some of the financial statement audit work that we do also go into a variety of different entities, mainly state agencies, but also some boards and commissions, and do audits that are very focused on the adequacy of their internal control and their compliance with financially related statutes and policies. When we take a look at internal controls, we're not just working from some concept that we have or that we've developed about what we think would be good, a good control process for an agency. We're really working from a structure that's been very widely accepted throughout industry and throughout government. The roots of that are based back in the mid-1980s when a committee called the Committee of Sponsoring Organizations got together. It's abbreviated to be called COSO, and you may have heard that acronym. COSO was a group of accounting agencies like the AICPA, the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants, or the Internal Auditors Association and several others. They put together a committee that defined what internal controls are and also identified what the main elements of those controls are. Shortly after that came out, we started using that as our framework, but it really wasn't very widely adopted throughout the industry until after the Exxon situation. It got incorporated into Sarbanes-Oxley and became a required framework for publicly traded companies as they developed their control systems. Those control systems needed to be consistent with the COSO model and needed to be validated by management that the controls were in place, and then the auditors would come in and determine whether or not management's validation, management's assertion that the controls were well-designed, whether or not that was valid. So that COSO model started trickling into government, started getting into our audit standards, and recently it got adopted into state policy. The Department of Finance does have an internal control policy that's applicable to all state agencies that says that each agency, each department must have internal controls that are designed along the same model and principles as COSO. And I'd like to just briefly go through what the five elements of the COSO model are, because that really is how we structure our approach to examining internal controls within a state agency. It's the basis on which we do have findings for those agencies and then make recommendations. So the first element is the control environment within an agency, and that's really where we're looking for the leadership, the management of that department, to be setting a firm foundation, a firm expectation that good internal controls, good financial management will exist. And in recent audits that you know, the Minneapolis Vets Home we discussed this morning, I think some of you were there, you know, that really was something that we felt did not exist in the Minneapolis Vets Home, that they did not have a firm management, a firm oversight, a firm expectation that there would be good financial management. So the control environment is something that's very important. It's sometimes called the tone at the top. And it's kind of a do as I do, not as I say. It's more than just putting out the words. It's also following through on, holding people accountable and monitoring how things are working. And that management is not going to look the other way if things are not going well. Other examples that we have reported on recently where I would say crosses over into tone at the top might be the Perfect Center, where there's been more of a history of a change in management and continued problems, and the Faribault academies for the deaf and blind. Also, we seem to go into those environments and find continued problems and not really addressing issues. They might address an issue, but not the concept more broadly. So we do feel that in those situations, the tone at the top needs some improvement and some strengthening. The second element of the COSA model is risk assessment. And this is really something that we do not see a lot of effort being put into in state government in the agencies that we're in. That's where the agency steps back in their processes and says, where could things go wrong? Where could fraud occur? Where could errors happen? Where could mistakes be made? What are our weak links? And what is the priority of those things? So sometimes risk assessment happens after a fraud is discovered. People say, well, how did this happen? And sometimes what we'll see is that those holes are plugged, but a broader look needs to be taken about, throughout the whole process, where are our risks, where are our vulnerabilities, what are the important things, how do we define that risk, and what are we going to do about it? The next area of COSA, the third element, is control activities. And that's really where when we have findings, we identify weaknesses, we make recommendations, we're usually in this area. What procedures are put in place in order to prevent errors, detect errors, prevent fraud, and ensure good financial management, integrity of the financial data? We're looking at those controls and we're making recommendations to improve that process. So the control procedures or control activities is really the area that's probably the best understood by agencies. The next area has to do with information and communication, and that's how does an organization communicate from the top all the way down to the account clerk who's making the deposit, what the controls are, why the controls are important, and what the expectations are. I think when we did our review of combative sports, the Combative Sports Commission, that was an area where we were sometimes even surprised. We tell them, well, don't you realize that you have to get the deposits in within, by statute, the deposits have to go in daily. And they're like, well, we weren't aware of that. And we talked about the conflict of interest applicable to state employees. Well, we weren't aware that it applied to us. So there was some lack of communication about what the rules and regulations were, what the expectations were, and what the control processes needed to be within that organization. Another example of that, I think, would be also the DNR conference, where at the commissioner level, a statement was made that costs were not going to be incurred by the department related to the conference, but somehow that did not get clearly communicated to the people that were planning and facilitating the conference, and costs were incurred. So information and communication throughout the organization about control is really important. And the last area is monitoring. And monitoring whether or not the controls are working the way they're supposed to be working. A lot of times people will say, well, that's what the auditors are supposed to do. Some recent changes in the audit standards have really clearly drawn the line that is not an auditor responsibility, not an external auditor like we are externally from the organization. That really is management's responsibility to make sure that they have ways of knowing whether or not the controls that they've identified are working the way that they're supposed to be working. And so that's really an area that we believe needs to be reinforced and strengthened within the agencies that we're looking at.
Mr. Noble.
Mr. Chairman, first I want to apologize for my sniffles. I've read recently that it's one of the three most irritating things in the office environment, but I can't help it. But I want to just close our piece by saying that, we take our work very seriously. We find it pretty intense. We certainly try to be very respectful of the people that we're interacting with. But we do think that public money should be spent under very tight controls. There ought to be all of the things that Ms. Ruckel just referred to, proper authorizations, a good public purpose, and all the sorts of internal controls. We also think that auditing is an essential part of achieving accountability and strengthening legislative oversight, but we cannot do this work alone. We are really looking very much for partners and allies, and we look certainly within the management of any organization that we are auditing to join with us to solve the problems that we found, and to even take it further to look for other potential vulnerabilities that we may not have found in a particular audit. Because most audits are looking just at a slice of an organization, not at everything. And so they are warning signs, and we so very much encourage management to look even further through the risk assessments and through all of the things, again, that Ms. Ferkel referred to. But we are also looking increasingly to the Department of Finance, now called Office of Management and Budget, to join with us in a kind of shared leadership in emphasizing these points. We think that it is important to send a strong message throughout state government, throughout the agencies, that these things really do matter, that it matters when there is an article in the paper that talks about a fraud or a theft or some misuse of public funds. It hurts the credibility, we think, significantly, and it damages the public trust. And so while our job is to find those things, to disclose them, and ultimately oftentimes they are talked about in the media, what we're really working towards here is good government. And for us, good government, it's a lot of different things to different people, but for us in particular, it really is good, strong financial management. And so, Mr. Chairman, we very much appreciate your interest, the interest of members of this committee and other committees that are reviewing our reports. I think that helps us send a strong message throughout state government that it's not only the auditors that care about these things, but it's the elected representatives of the people that care very much, too. So thank you.
Representative Pepin.
Thank both of you for coming here. Mr. Nobles, I was discouraged the other day in Finance Committee. You passed out a packet of, I think it was about 16 commissions, councils, agencies that you've audited. And the reason I was discouraged is because I remember sitting probably in this room probably 4 years ago, and I know that there's at least one, probably more, of the councils that had been audited in the past and had very similar results. I won't name those here. Certainly the VEST Board is one of concern as well, because I noticed on the packet that you'd passed out they had not complied with recommendations in the past. When we're talking about controls, I'm wondering, first of all, how many of those 16 or how many aggregate, perhaps, are repeat offenders where this happens? Because it seems like it should never happen that we... It seems like there should be a way where if they've... if they're not doing what they're supposed to, if their controls aren't in place, the next time you go there, they should be in place. And if they're not, there should be a penalty. And so my question to you is, what should that penalty be? Because obviously, whatever we're doing now isn't enough. So in a perfect world, do you have any suggestions as to what that penalty should be? Or maybe you should talk about what it is, because it doesn't seem like whatever we're doing is working. Because I would like to see audits come back to say that the problem has been corrected, instead of sitting here 4 years from now and seeing that nothing has changed.
Mr. Chairman and members, I appreciate the question very much, because we do believe that there should be consequences to some of the problems that we find, and there can be a range of consequences. As was mentioned by the state auditor, we sometimes find things that require that we go to a county attorney and seek criminal prosecution. That's actually a requirement in our statute that we do that, and we do that because we also think it can have some deterrent effect. So if we find something that could rise to the level of a criminal complaint or indictment, we will work in that direction. We also work in the direction through the Attorney General to get recovery of funds. But we also sometimes find things that are lesser offenses than that, but there still should be consequences. And we do not have any power to levy fines or consequences. I certainly talk from time to time with people in the executive branch, either commissioners or even in the governor's office, about some of the problems that we're finding. And it is obviously up to the governor on occasion or a commissioner to levy a consequence to someone who's appointed by the governor or a commissioner. That's their prerogative. Now, we don't make specific personnel recommendations that someone should be fired or suspended, but I think that should be the consequence in some cases, and I will, if that's my view, communicate that privately to either someone in the governor's office or to a commissioner. Ultimately, of course, they may have to go through a certain personnel process, but we think that's a process worth going through. I would mention a couple of cases. You all remember the Sonia Pitt episode. Again, one of those very difficult situations for state government. I think the name Sonia Pitt will live on for years as a person who did great harm to state government. We did seek criminal prosecution. That did not occur, although she was ultimately terminated. But one of the things that we thought also should occur is that people who supervised her and actually authorized some of her travel, but also were simply not attentive enough to some of her unauthorized activities, should bear some consequence, and they did. There was some disciplinary action against some of her supervisors. Beyond that, again, it's a matter of calling up someone in a position of responsibility and discussing what we see as the gravity of the situation. But ultimately, it will be up to either the governor as the appointing authority for certain people or a commissioner. Another case I would cite is the conference, the DNR conference, that again was a matter of some publicity that we also investigated. There was some consequence to some employees who were involved in that. Two people were terminated and others were disciplined. But again, we cannot take that action. We can suggest it privately. We don't formally make those recommendations in our report. But we certainly communicate the gravity of the situation and do believe there should be consequences.
Representative Petten.
Thank you. That's a very thorough answer, Mr. Nobles. I just have one follow-up question, and this is an opinion question, so I hope you feel comfortable answering it. Do you feel or can you make recommendations as to whether or not an organization, a council, probably not an agency, can be in any way penalized by being defunded?
Mr. Nobles.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, again, a good point and one that often comes up, and it creates a real dilemma, I think. As I have gone to some briefings of legislators and talked about situations that we've uncovered, that is oftentimes, I think, the consequence that you can levy as the appropriating branch of state government. You can cut funding. That oftentimes, potentially at least, could make the situation worse. I mean, I understand why that may be what needs to happen. If an organization can't manage the public's money well, then why should you give it to them? Or maybe they should have less of it. I understand that as a consequence, but sometimes some organization, and it depends on the situation, may be struggling, you know, to manage the resources because they don't have a good computer system or they don't have enough people. Give you an example. You created, this legislature created, something called the Combative Sports Commission. You decided it should exist. You created it in law. Collectively, you decided. And the governor appointed the executive director and a board. It has very little money. I think you appropriated about $50,000 for this organization to carry out its legal regulatory duties. That may not be enough, but we can certainly tell you from the audit or investigation that we did, they're not doing a very good job of managing the $50,000. So you might well ask, should we give them more? Well, not until they clean things up. Not until, frankly, we get serious about that function. Should it still exist? That's up for you to decide. But I can tell you that if you decide that that still should be a state entity carrying out state regulatory responsibilities, somebody somewhere needs to do something to make that function better because, frankly, based on what we saw, they weren't doing anything right. Now, the executive director is appointed
by the governor. The board is appointed by the governor. Is that where the consequence should come from? Again, it's not for me to say. But if that board comes to you and asks for maybe more money, I don't think, based on what we learned, you can have a lot of confidence until you can be assured that that is going to be run in a much more professional and business-like way. So, a bit of a dilemma. But there it is.
Thank you.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nobles, a quick personal note that you should be grateful that I'm not on the Pension Commission, because I'd move for the rule of 900 for you and your office, because you do such an fine work. And on the Sonia Pitt experience, having had somebody blow the whistle to me about the training issue that your office is incredibly helpful with and dealt with extremely professionally, including deciding not to formally look into that element of the scandal, as it were. And so, I think discretion was better part of valor, and I want to commend you for that piece of it. One of the components of that investigation was working with MnDOT's Office of Audit, and I'm wondering if you could comment on the whether those offices exist, or similar kind of inspector general as they have at federal agencies, and what your relationship is with those offices where they do exist.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Palin, thank you. And the internal auditors from MnDOT are here, and we really appreciate them, and we appreciate the fact that MnDOT has that office. They actually were the people who did the initial investigation of Sonia Pitt before it was then turned over to us. So having those kinds of trained professionals with a degree of independence in state agencies, we think, is a very good thing. There are not very many of them. They are scattered here and there. You actually have, in state law, an encouragement, as I recall it, if not an actual requirement, that the Commissioner of Finance encourage the development of internal audit offices in state agencies and coordinate the standards and practice of that. I think that needs some encouragement by you and by the legislature. Obviously, it's difficult to do in tough budget times. But again, we believe that we can only do so much with the resources that we have. We haven't talked, frankly, about a lot of the things that we do in addition to the audits that we're kind of focusing on here. And so, as with the state auditor's office, we're a bit stretched thin. State government is very large, very complex, and quite decentralized. And so we are always looking for allies to emphasize and take leadership on some of the same concerns that we have. And so where there is an internal audit office, we appreciate them and we establish relationships with them. I would point to another organization that has a very strong internal audit office, and that's at Minsky. Actually, the former deputy legislative auditor is the director of that. And we think that's a very good model. And they take a very strong hand in the financial issues of the management of Minsky. Another model that I would throw out to you that is somewhat similar to the internal audit function, and that is the Office of Enterprise Technology with its internal security concern. Again, the director of that is a former employee of the Office of Legislative Auditor. The director of security for OET is Chris Boozy. Some of you, I think, are familiar with him. But he, too, comes with a perspective that the problems in one particular department are not just the problems of that department. They are the problems of the enterprise of state government. And we can't say, well, that was just the Barber's Board or that was just the Department of Health. We as state government have to take ownership of these problems and issues. And we can't just leave it to somebody else to solve. So when we do an IT security audit, somebody from Chris Boozy's office is there with us, looking at those issues, talking to those agency people about how they're going to solve those problems. And there is a high expectation that they are going to solve those problems. It is not acceptable in state government for them to have insecure websites. We think, again, that's a good model for the Department of Finance to follow. not to say that when we find problems, that's somebody else's problem, that the Commissioner of Health or Transportation will take care of it. Yes, they have some responsibility, but I think there's also a role for the Department of Finance, Management, and Budget Office. So I hope that responded to your question.
Representative Palin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Nobles, I think it did quite a bit, and I think there's more thought that I think needs to be put into how we strengthen those internal offices and fund them in these tough times and look at the cost effectiveness of doing so. Which leads to, I think, something that Representative Pepin was going to. If you could describe a little bit more of the structural follow-up of audits, especially when you do programmatic audits and you make recommendations to cure gaps in programs. I had an analogy just being the bridge inspection process is one of the things that on the Transportation Committee last few years we've been really harping on is finding issues, are you solving them after you find them?
Well, let me break it into two parts because they're somewhat different. With financial audits, we make almost, I'd say all of our recommendations really are to the agency. And the Department of Finance does send a letter to every commissioner saying, the legislative auditor has made these recommendations and please give us a quarterly report on the follow-up. And so we get those, but as was mentioned, the implementation doesn't always occur. And we do go back periodically and examine in an agency where we have had findings. But we have responsibility to audit about 160 to 180 different organizations. We have to audit some of them every year, and we do a lot of other work. We audit the state's financial statements. So we're sort of left with a fairly small number of hours to use to go and do these kinds of audits that we're talking about right now. And so every year we go through a risk assessment and we look at all of those organizations from the Department of Transportation to the Barbers Board to the Chicano Latino Council, and all of them are on our plate. And so we have to decide which ones are we going to go to this year. Sometimes we have to go places. We go to the state fair every year. It's mandated by law. We audit the constitutional officers, as was mentioned, twice within every term. So some of our resources are just sort of taken off the table by requirements. Then we're left with some discretionary resources, and then we go into the risk assessment. And organizations that, for whatever reason, seem to be problematic, and there can be a variety of criteria that lead to that assessment, would be high on our list. But you could be high on our list, and we wouldn't come to you every year. Even if we find problems, there may be problems elsewhere. But we do try to get back to those organizations that have been problematic more frequently. I think one of the things that really shook us a bit about the Sonia Pitt situation was that as we had gone through our risk assessments over the years and where to deploy our resources, we sort of thought the big state agencies like MnDOT were pretty tightly managed, and you wouldn't have Sonia Pitt-type situations. And so they, frankly, were a little lower, and they also have a strong internal audit office. So they didn't rise to the level on our risk assessment very frequently. We would more likely go to some of the more outlying boards and commissions that don't get as much attention from the Department of Finance, or they're not, for whatever reason, quite within the structure of state government as much. Sonia Pitt told us, we cannot be so certain that even the big state agencies are being that well managed. So what you saw in this last round of audits is that we did go to some of the big state agencies, not just to the little boards and councils and commissions. And we found problems there, too. So there's work to be done everywhere. Now, again, we do try to get back periodically to really put to the test, did you implement the recommendation and did you solve the problem? And unfortunately, as Representative Pepin pointed out, this latest list of reports shows that in certain places the problems are not getting corrected. With program evaluations, it's a little bit different. A lot of our recommendations are to the legislature, actually, as well as to the agencies. And the Department of Finance does not track those in quite the same way, because oftentimes they are not strictly internal control type issues. They're broader, more policy and management concerns. We do periodically ask commissioners to report to us what they've done to correct problems and implement recommendations from program evaluations. And periodically we go in on a very limited basis because of the limitation of our staffing and resources, and we'll do our own independent follow-up review. One, for example, I would point out that we did last year, a year before, was on Health Match. We had gone in and found significant problems in Health Match, a very high level of error in eligibility determinations, with Minnesota Care, which was, and then we got to Health Match because that was going to be the solution. And so when we, and so we wanted to go back and see where is Health Match in terms of solving those problems, because it had been promised and the department had said they were going to do a variety of other things to improve eligibility determination. And unfortunately, we found that Health Match was not nearly as far along as the administration had said. In fact, it was and now has been canceled, essentially. And that the department really had not improved the eligibility determination very much. So this is turning into kind of a sad story. I don't mean it to be.
Unlike most auto presentations.
I think we do have impact, and things do improve because of our work. I just somehow fixated on some of the more negative examples. I don't know.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, and Mr. Nobles and Ms. Purple. Thank you for your time today at being here. Very helpful and informational. As a nurse, certainly in years past, I used to pull teeth or maybe fill cavities, and then we became aware of prevention, the wonderful right. thing. Why go there at all? And so while I appreciate the after the fact, I think that is very important, but I know you've alluded to it somewhat already in regards to the Minnesota Management and Budget Office, a shared effort to, I think, focus on prevention and other things like that. You've alluded that to some degree. Are we going to hear more about that, or is that something I should just wait and hear more about it? Or
well, I think, Mr. Chairman, Representative Kiffmeyer, I think at some point you certainly should hear from the Commissioner of Finance, Office of Management and Budget. I think someone representing them is here, but maybe at some future meeting. We talk to them frequently. I've talked to the Commissioner himself about this issue. We had a meeting last week. But ultimately, it will be to some degree up to the Commissioner and the Governor to decide how strong a position that office is going to take on some of these issues, but we certainly do see a large role for them, because we really do believe, as you just said, prevention is what we ought to be about. We are taking, I would say, a higher visibility or leadership role to some degree in going to conferences, meetings of state managers, and certainly making presentations. Ms. Ferkel has done that. I will be doing that in February. I understand the governor is going to have a government accountability or financial integrity conference, and we will certainly participate in that and speak and make our concerns known to the managers and state government. So that is very much an important part of the process.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Hi, Mr. Chairman and members. It seems as though we have spent a number of amount of time in regards to this, and it seems like we really need to hear from the MMB office, and if the governor has some plans or things like that, I would certainly be interested. It may not necessarily take a legislative action, but we've heard a lot about that, and so I would really like to hear about some of the prevention training or curative measures, and certainly I don't want things like this veterans home where they're not, I think most of the time, 99.9% of the time, they do respond to your comments and make those changes and correct those things. It's very unusual to have something like this, I think, just go on and don't like it at all, and especially it seems to be a trend. So, Mr. Chairman, members, if we can kind of really maybe focus some of our time, too, on what are some of those prevention things that we can either initiate
cooperate with, support, whatever we can do.
Representative Kiffmeyer, I think that is the intention of the committee. And this committee holds the purse string for the Department of Finance as well, so we get to ask more detailed questions about their plans and agency mission than you might have a chance to in other committees. And that actually leads me to a question to Mr. Nobles. For those who didn't have the benefit of being at the Finance Committee hearing yesterday, you discussed actually what you described as an emerging pattern of increased problems with internal controls and just control and compliance audits that this most recent round demonstrated. And it was a huge number of places. I mean, employee relations, health, labor and industry, agriculture, the IRRRB, Purpose Center, all these small boards and commissions. I think that you described this as a pattern that has developed, and I think it would be helpful for those of us on the committee to hear just an overview, at least a brief overview of what you have found in your most recent round of audits.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think to put it in a nutshell, what we found is inadequate internal controls. If Ms. Ferkel were to go through her list of things that should be there, and that is sort of the template that we apply in terms of separation of duties, securing assets, bank reconciliations, timely deposits, all of the things that the state auditor referred to, and which we look at as well, we found inadequacies and deficiencies. And again, we found them virtually everywhere we looked, and that was the disturbing thing. You know, sometimes you may want to be a little more charitable towards some organizations, again, because they're small, and they may have a challenge separating duties, or they're just not a part of state government as much. But when you go to the Department of Health and you find that they have a lot of gift cards that are just sort of sitting around, not secured, it's kind of a situation like the state auditor referred to. They can easily disappear. And so those are the kinds of things that we found surprising. And so that is the pattern. It's a lack of separation of duties. It's too many people being authorized to do things that are incompatible with each other. It's not securing assets. It's not making timely deposits. I don't know, Ms. Ferkel wants to mention other things.
Ms. Ferkel?
Mr. Chair and members, some of the things when we went into these large agencies, we still did have kind of a mindset that we weren't going to encounter a lot of problems. You know, even with the DOT situation that we had just come out of, we went into the Department of Health, we went into the Department of Labor and Industry thinking that we were going to find things to be fairly good and that maybe we were misdirecting our resources by going into these large agencies where they have a lot of people that know accounting and they know what controls are and they have, a broad management and maybe we should be going to the small boards. After we got in the door and started looking at some of these processes, we, you know, really have felt that the large agencies, although they have more resources to work with, they also have the weak controls that are very concerning. And you know, it's concerning when you go to a board of barbers and cosmetology and you see $100,000 at risk through a year in their license fees, but it's really concerning when you go to the Department of Health and you see $36 million that's coming through their doors without adequate controls every year, and is it getting to the bank or is it not getting to the bank? We had a discussion with one agency who said, you know, and we hear this, our employees are very good, they're very competent, we trust them. Well, if your control system rests only on the trust and integrity of particular employees, you really do not have a control system. And that's sometimes what we see. Even as a big agent, and we had some other people say, well, we'll accept the risk of incompatible duties. That's something that, to us, as we have seen frauds occur, it becomes really apparent that that fundamental control of separating duties involving more than one person in a process is really critical. To have somebody that's responsible for an accounting department say to us, well, I'm going to accept the risk, you know, I just have to turn back to them and say, you don't understand the risk then, because you can't accept that. You have to design some kinds of mitigating controls
or you have to eliminate that opportunity, or you simply are not performing good financial management over these resources. So when we are in the agencies, we do talk pretty tough to them, and we do try to get their attention. But at the end of the audit, we walk out the door, and it's left on their plate to resolve the issues. And we really do hope that the Department of Finance provides that kind of guidance to them to help them get good practices in place.
Mr. Chairman, I will, you know, as long as we're giving you the whole story here. I mean, the other one that we haven't mentioned, which again shook us a bit, and that was the fraud that has now been reported in the media that occurred at the Department of Human Services. We have not yet written a report on that. We have done some investigative work at the department to determine how it occurred. It's a little bit of an awkward situation in that there is an ongoing case for prosecution through the U.S. Attorney. But I believe at some point soon there needs to be a public airing of how that occurred, and we will deliver that to you. Because, as I mentioned to the Finance Committee yesterday, I think sometimes there is a temptation in organizations to say, this was just a bad apple. This was a rogue employee. We don't accept that. These things do not happen unless there are inadequate controls. If you give somebody who is that motivated to steal money an opportunity, you know, it's not just their problem, it's your problem too. They will be prosecuted and they will bear some consequence. But you are, as an organization, I think, have to look very critically at why and how that occurred. And what we encourage, and what we will encourage in this case as well, and it's a point that Ms. Furkle emphasized, and that is, you know, when you know the steps that that person took to steal that money, in this case it was close to $1 million, of various transactions over a fairly extended period of time, you need to make sure that you don't just solve that problem, but you look broadly at the maybe 7 or 8 or 10 or 15 other ways that person or somebody else might have perpetrated a fraud as well. So that's why we need to look not just at the misdeeds of the individual, but the controls that allowed it to happen. So, Mr. Chairman, I off the top of my head, I can't think of any other horror stories to tell you. But
well, Mr. Nobles and members, you know, as a obviously not the committee chair, but I think Phyllis is interested in exploring more broadly this issue of enterprise financial management. What is really at issue in state government broadly, since a number of those departments, the kind of core services of government, come through this committee? I think it's the right place to do it, and to look at what initiatives the Department of Finance may be undertaking, what additional steps the legislative auditor might suggest, and overall what we need to do as we deal with budget that we're going to have to pass through this committee also, where we prioritize money to make sure that as we deal with a more difficult economic environment, more money isn't just walking out the door of state government. So I think that this is really, in a way, just laying the groundwork for additional follow-up that we'll do, as Representative Kiffmeyer has mentioned. So thank you for your testimony. Unless there are other questions from the committee? Okay,
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And now we have Tom Barrett from the Gambling Control Board, the Executive Director. We will try to end at 4:15, which is our scheduled time. So I hope, Mr. Barrett, that you have a snappy presentation, and the committee questions are short and pithy. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Tom Barrett. I'm the director of the Gambling Control Board. And as the introductory comments were, not sure how this fit, but I do appreciate the honor, the opportunity to be here. Charitable gambling in Minnesota is huge, and we do touch base with the legislative auditor. We do touch base with the state auditor and our responsibilities in regulating the industry. But briefly, what is charitable gambling? It's the pull tabs you see out in the bar, the raffles, take keep my fight at the church, the bingo halls, the paddle wheels, those things. We don't regulate the lottery. We don't oversee the horse track or the card rooms, and we don't oversee the tribal entities. But yet we share information with those respective regulators, and it's a good thing. Charitable gambling in Minnesota is number one in the country, $1.2 billion in gross receipts last fiscal year. I expect we'll be coming back to the committee with an overview, but when you understand the significance and the size of the scope of the industry that we're monitoring, it's huge. Number one in the country, we're one of the smallest in terms of regulation. Now, when I say that, we still have a pretty good thing in Minnesota. The laws in the books, the rules that are in place following the conduct are pretty good. We're constantly working with the industry on working towards tweaks, but we do have a good thing, and the charities have a lot to do with it and good management oversight. Last year, they contributed over $50 million to true charitable causes. The state is a benefactor of the proceeds from gambling. $43 million went to the state in the form of tax receipts. We're keeping an eye on over 1,300 fully licensed organizations, the VFWs, the American Legions, Fire Relief Associations, those things. 3,000 sites around Minnesota are conducting charitable gambling. So given the size of the industry, I am happy to report that for the most part, things are very well run. Organizations are doing what they should do, but unfortunately we do have situations where fraud, and that's when the call came. Tom, what do you think about coming in? And it's a good opportunity because while there's a lot of good, there are some issues. We've heard about the internal controls. We've heard about, you know, the inventory checks. A lot of the same things we see at the very small level of charity bode well in terms of whether it's the large state agencies or the local unit of the governments. But we work closely with the charities. Before a charity is licensed, they have to identify who amongst their members are going to be is going to be the gambling manager. We spend time and effort to train the person to be knowledgeable of the laws and the rules. We conduct training throughout the year to keep them fresh. We have specific rules that how do you play, how do you report pull tab games, those things. And we work close with revenue, taxes, monthly reports going in. All those things kind of add up to keep the integrity of the industry as honest as they can. But unfortunately, there's times when problems happen. And what's the number one cause, as you've heard before? It's one person being put in charge of too many things. Number one, without a doubt. And yet with all the training, all the background information we provide, undoubtedly we find problems where that one person is doing too much and that leads to the problem. It's okay to trust the person, but you can't always trust everybody. And that's the unfortunate nature. We have good rules. We require every organization to submit their separation of duties and who's doing what. And while that looks good on paper, times when we go out to do the audit, they're not doing what's on the paper. And that's unfortunate because then it comes with the penalties and what we need to do in terms of taking action. But there is theft. There's fraud. We see for different reasons. You've heard whether it's financial or addiction or something. They get behind, and that's when the risk takers. No better time than what we're seeing right now. When the economic forecast looks the way it does, we see increases using the fraud triangle, as the state auditor alluded to. All those things play in, even at the small level, dealing with the charities. And it's something that obviously we're very mindful of. But there is clear warning signs that we use. And we share this information. We tell the charities, we're going to be looking at your deposits. We're going to be looking at your inventory. We're going to be looking at the prize receipts. All those things that are real easy to understand, but tools that they could look and say, are we doing the right thing? I don't mean to joke here, but our number one informant as relates to charitable gambling is ex-spouses. But the cause or the correlation is when things are wrong, all of a sudden there's a freedom to share the information. Because obviously we're mindful of where the information comes from. Another source is the players, that they feel cheated in the way the game was handled, or that maybe after hours playing. We follow up on the allegations, and to the extent of how involved or how important it is or how big it could be, we do work with local law enforcement. We do work with counterparts of public safety when it gets to the illegal. Anybody have numbers on the football game this weekend? Okay, good. Illegal. But we do have situations, and I just briefly talk about a couple of cases, but it really drives home the point of the industry we're looking at and some of the unfortunate things that happen. I talk about Peggy Sue. My auditors found a charitable organization that things just didn't add up right. We looked a little more into it. There's enough supporting evidence that this person was stealing. So we called local law enforcement and said, hey, we're going to be coming to your town. We need your help because we're hopeful we get a confession, which will lead to a criminal prosecution. Well, who is it? Well, it's Peggy Sue. And this is coming from a local law enforcement. No way. I know Peggy Sue, and there's no way she would have stolen the money. You're wrong. Well, you hear things like that, we kind of backpedal and go, are we sure? No. We're confident. So we made contact with the county. Hey, we need your help here. We go up to the location. Peggy Sue brings in who? The local law enforcement person in her corner to speak as a character witness, which is fine. The unfortunate point is within 5 minutes she was admitting to the theft. The law enforcement was standing with the mouth open, and it was a point of trust. The person got behind the bills, but the person was trusted. And unfortunately, it didn't work out. We talk about other things, and we do training for, we attend the Legion conventions, the VFW and the Lions and all those, and we preach or talk of things to look for. And we talk about gambling managers. We put a lot of effort to train the gambling managers. And we ask the gambling managers, share the information, do the monthly reports, be more than providing in terms of the information. But undoubtedly we'll have an organization that says, geez, we just can't get information from our gambling managers. Well, what did they say? Well, they said not to worry about it. When you hear those words, don't worry about it, you need to worry about it. And I don't mean, again, to make light, but those are some of the things that they should be more than willing to share. They're sharing monthly reports to us, revenue, why not to the local members? And so when we say, just hold them accountable. Simply ask us. You're right to ask for the information. We get it, and we share it. But unfortunately, when we hear things like that, there's like a bit of the power struggle. They want to have the information. They want to control it. Another brief case we call mixing the money. This involved a specific 501c3 organization that by law they could contribute proceeds from the gambling into their general fund. And we track, do a lot of the audits on the gambling activity. But once it goes into the general, we lose some of that sight as far as our limited authority. But this was a situation that started out with a very small bingo operation and ultimately ended up with FBI. And it was one of the featured police chases on Wildest Police Chases out in California. Well, how can that happen from Minnesota? It was a case where the CEO was very controlling, to the point when the money got into their general account, there wasn't as much reporting as you would see normally with the lawful gambling. But because of our oversight and providing the information, the numbers simply didn't add up. But what the person was doing was buying land literally out in California, doing the wire transfers, hence why we got the FBI involved. But it was a good thing in the sense the property was seized, the charity was made whole, the state got a little bit of the action as well. But it was an example where even at the CEO level, the controls weren't there. Okay, wrapping up.
Thank you, Mr. Fair.
Thank you. We talked about the penalty and maybe some of the limitations with the Legislative Auditor's Office when dealing with the state agency. The board has the authority to impose civil penalties. If we find cases that are criminal in nature, then we transfer that to the public safety. But we do have everything from a small fine to license revocation. And I'll be honest, we take action. It's not the board's wish to shut down the charities, but if we find cases that are bad enough, we will take action. And sometimes when it calls for a license suspension, we have charities that get suspended. Undoubtedly, we'll get some calls from legislators, and that's fine. Keep us honest, too. But they want to know, why did we shut them down? And my first question back to you all is, what did they tell you? And then we share the information in terms of, here's what we found, here's the limitations. But once they realize how the whole story, then it's like, okay, that's unfortunate, but we'll see about getting them back up to speed, relicensed, get back in. But what does work, we're going to continue with gambling committees. We encourage organizations, get groups, get more people involved. We looked at the prop reporting. We share that information. And I think the bottom line, maybe to wrap up here, $1.2 billion, huge industry. We're holding our own, okay? There's issues that we try to stay on top of it. But we work very closely with the charitable organizations in terms of their operations. We work closely as it pertains to some legislative changes, and it's a good thing. The sense of balance I think we need to maintain. Is there fraud and theft? Yep. But to the point that we're ahead of it, are we mindful of what happens? That's what we're trying to do. So I appreciate, again, the opportunity. Hopefully it's brief enough. But it's important, and I think, going back to the committee, to understand what the board does and how it affects the local charities in your communities.
Thank you, Mr. Barrett. I think we probably will have you back at some point for a broader overview. And given that fact, and that I guess if any member feels a burning desire to get a question on the record, which I don't see any, we can excuse you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Last announcement, I guess, is just that the next meeting will not be until next Thursday, the 22nd of January. And so, without anything further, we are adjourned.